across the ocean, from sea to shining sea. Different kinds of people sing a sweet harmony. Take a look around you, think about what you see. We can live together, side by side, you and me. One song that the whole world can sing, one voice that together will bring, one hope that above everything the whole world can sing. One song. Everyone's a brother or a sister that you meet. We are all one family, living on the same street. So let's sing together a song with beautiful sound. All the music that we make will spread love all around. One song that the whole world can sing, one voice that together will bring, one hope that above everything the whole world can sing. One song. One song.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Daniel Ellsberg from January 4th, 2001. Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, discusses the destabilization of Pakistan, how counterinsurgencies often provoke civil war, and the underestimation of Israel's nuclear arsenal. This is about an hour. And then after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Kohlberg. This is about 27 minutes.
For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. And I'm happy to welcome Daniel Ellsberg back to the show. He is the heroic Rand Corporation Department of Defense whistleblower who stole and leaked, at the risk of the rest of his life, the Pentagon Papers. The secret history of the Vietnam War and Richard Nixon's persecution of Dan Ellsberg is ultimately what led to his downfall and him being the first president forced to resign in disgrace. Dan Ellsberg's website is danellsberg.net. And his book is called Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. And I believe you can often find what he writes at truthdig.com. Happy New Year, Dan. Welcome back to the show.
Happy New Year. Very good to be here to start the new year this way with you, Scott. One little correction there. My website is not danellsberg.net. It's ellsberg.net.
Oh, that's right. It is just ellsberg.net. Now, I wonder, it sort of sounded wrong coming out of my mouth there, and I wasn't sure why, but there you go.
Close.
Sorry about that. All right, so there we go. And in fact, you know what? As long as we're on that specific topic, what happened to Chapter 1? I always want to link to Chapter 1 of Secrets by Dan Ellsberg, where you tell the story of how it was your first day on the job as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for killing people, and you got all the information about the Gulf of Tonkin and the big bogus attack that never happened that justified Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam War. But it's not on Dan Ellsberg, or it's not on Ellsberg.net anymore that I can find.
Okay, I thought I had it on. I'll check again. I put that on actually the month that the book came out into the stores. I had the first chapter on the web because I'd asked my publisher if I could put several chapters on, and they said they limited me to one. The reason I wanted it on right then was that we were about to reproduce that experience, which we did proceed to do by Congress passing what amounted to a new Tonkin Gulf resolution, giving the president a blank check to go to war in Iraq. And I had hoped, by warning people of the lies that had surrounded the first Tonkin Gulf resolution, that senators might be warned off of doing that again. As a matter of fact, the two senators who had still been in the Senate at that time, 2002, who had been in the Senate to vote on the first Tonkin Gulf resolution in 1964, Senator Robert Byrd and Senator Ted Kennedy, and each of them was spending their time that month warning in almost pleading terms. I believe Byrd actually put it, I beg you not to make the same mistake we did, not to do something that you'll regret for the rest of your life, as I have.
Well, that was the greatest speech Byrd ever gave in all his generations in the Imperial Senate, too.
Yeah.
So it really was a
warning,
great speech.
Warning was missed, you know, didn't work. And we went ahead, gave the president a blank check to go ahead to protect us from terrorist attacks by attacking a country that had nothing to do, literally nothing to do with 9/11, posed no threat whatever to the United States at that time, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and with the effect, by all CI estimates then, since then, of having increased the threat to the United States of terrorist attacks by convincing 1.5 billion Muslims around the world that the U.S. is on a crusade against Islam. Somewhat misleading inference. It's not that U.S. leaders have anything against Islam per se. It's just that Muslims tend to live on top of oil that we want to control. So they're in our way if they're not totally cooperative. So to make an increasing number of people in the world, perhaps at the very peak of that right now, Pakistan being attacked by Obama's drones this year, hate us, not simply, you know, not be aligned with us or recognize that they're a different state, but actually hate the United States is very unsafe in this world, especially in a country that is balanced between different factions in Pakistan.
Well, Dan, you know, this is
Islamic fundamentalist.
This is such an important thing, and it's one of those where, you know, the truth is one thing, and it's actually perfectly and completely obvious to anyone who, you know, cares to think about it for a moment that, you know, all this terrorism, it is, as Michael Scheuer said, it's an Islamist insurgency. But you can't have an insurgency against nothing. You have to have overriding power first to insurge against, and that would be the U.S. Empire. And I just wonder, how long can the war party go on? How long can the government go on pretending that we're not the ones who started this? I mean, it seems to me, you know, and I guess on a good day, I was cheating last night and smoked a couple cigarettes, so I was feeling pretty good, I guess. And I was thinking, you know, when Ron Paul went on TV the other day and said, come on, they're terrorists because we're occupiers, it was pretty clear that the only reason Ben Stein said, oh yeah, well, you're an anti-Semite, is because he had no other argument. It is so obviously true that they are terrorists because we're occupiers. Are we making any progress in at least getting past that they hate us because we're angels and they're devils thing? Can we even begin to really have a real conversation about this bogus terror war, you know, in the general public, and include the TV personalities in on it with us?
Well, there's no sign of it, we have to say. On your program, on antiwar.com, on the alternate media here, there is quite adequate understanding of that. In a way, it was hardly true in the time of Vietnam. We didn't have the internet, we didn't have the alternative sources here. But on the mainstream media, no, there is no change there. There's still spokespeople for the government handouts, essentially, and the government position is that we're there as friends, helpers, aiders, developers, and just impossible for us to perceive ourselves as foreigners who are in somebody else's country, who are trying to determine who shall govern them and who shall live and who shall die in that country as foreigners.
Uh-huh. Well, and, you know, I think an important part of this, you know, detail-wise, is that there's no such thing as Saudi Arabia to people who live on the Arabian Peninsula, really, except the princes themselves. I mean, this is a construction of the British Empire, and... You know, for example, if you read anything that bin Laden wrote in his old fatwas of 96 and 98 in the declaration of war against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places, it's the land of the two holy places. It's the Arabian Peninsula. And so, you know, George Bush actually gave in to bin Laden, I think correctly, and got as, if not all, a great proportion of the troops out of Saudi Arabia. But he just moved them all to Qatar and Bahrain and whatever, and into Iraq. And so that's not good enough. These borders are a distinction without a difference to the people who are mad at us. And, you know, Robert A. Pape, I'll throw in one more thing here and let you comment on it. Robert A. Pape, in his book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, he brought up a poll that was done in Saudi Arabia, a credible survey, where 91%, of course it was only the men who were asked, but still, 91% of them said that they wanted American combat forces off of the Arabian Peninsula entirely, immediately. And so it doesn't matter whether our puppet King Abdullah feels the same way as them. It would be like if the Iranians had, you know, puppet King Schwarzenegger of California or puppet King Rick Perry of Texas. It doesn't mean that the people of California or Texas have invited them to be our guests or that we're willing to tolerate their occupation of our land.
Okay, if you don't mind, though, I'd like to focus on the new war. You got us started here on... the war that got started in Iraq.
Well, I mean, Yemen's right there on the Arabian Peninsula. That's where we're going.
Yeah, let's talk about Afghanistan here right now. I'm very, very pessimistic, I have to say. And I won't say fatalistic because I'm talking to people here who have a chance. They have a chance to change this process as American citizens. And it's a small chance, as a matter of fact. And the obstacles are very great. The likelihood of success is not high. But the stakes are very high, and that means we have a responsibility to use the freedoms we do have to change Congress here, to change Congress's pressure, and to countervail the imperial interests, which work on Congress at the same time as we are speaking to them, but the imperial interests that work through the Pentagon and the CIA and the representatives of oil companies, oil investment, foreign investment, Wall Street, and so forth, that still prevail. The fact is, I think, though, that the odds are that, let's say, putting aside our overwhelming mobilization and efforts to change this, if that doesn't happen or if it's not effective, the future we have to look forward to in the next 10 years is a future of expanding war in Afghanistan, and it will not end at the end of this next decade unless there's a real change in the process here. There's no reason, I think, that this that our involvement, that our war against Afghanistan, really, will not continue decades to maintain bases there in that region critical to the oil of the world, and to try to dominate, to try to do what the Soviets tried to do, and I think with absolutely no respect, any reason to believe we will be more successful than the Soviets. Ultimately, that will kill fewer people. They killed a million people in their 10 years there. Will we kill less? That'll depend on us who are listening to this to a large extent. But leave it to the Pentagon, and it can be easily another million. And I emphasize that rather than what we hear about all the time, the Americans who will die. Yes, Americans will die. Their lives will be wasted in terms of American real interests and democratic values in our Constitution. They will have died in vain. I say that in bitter terms. And that will be a significant loss. But that is not the only way in which the cost of this effort should be measured. Afghans will die 10 to 1 in terms of the people we designate as enemies, and 100 to 1 in terms of civilians will die.
Well, and the headlines in just the last couple of days bear that out. And civilians dying all over the place. Now, the Karzai government posturing, saying, turn over the murderers to us for prosecution. Yeah, that'll be the day.
Well, you know, for 10 years now in Afghanistan in particular, we've been hearing reports of civilians being killed in airstrikes. And the American command always says, well, it's a very remote area. We can't get in there to check. Our estimates that only Taliban were killed are based, of course, on the images they get from the drones and interpreted 3,000 miles away. Karzai, our man in Kabul, will say, has said over and over again, as he's saying now, by the way, these are civilians, they're school children, they were unarmed people, old men, women, children, and so forth. We've been saying right along, we don't know, we're investigating, we'll let it go. Well, if those 30,000 men that we're putting in there now can do one thing, they could investigate what we're doing from the air and who we're killing. We shouldn't be hearing all the time, we're investigating, we'll let you know. The American people deserve to know how many civilians are being killed in our name day by day.
Well, now, as far as kind of, well, and you're right, too. I mean, there's a million dead Iraqis, and there's no reason to believe that if they can continue this war in Central Asia for, you know, decades, like they say they want to do, that the casualty numbers will eventually, you know, maybe sooner than later. Get that high. But, you know, you talk about, well, if the Pentagon gets their way, and this is something where, you know, I'm sort of playing dumb, but kind of not really. Maybe I am dumb. You know, it seems like Pepe Escobar says, you know, it's all about the pipeline politics, right? Eric Margulies, I think, signs on to a bit of that. But different people have different ideas. Some people say, well, what they really want is a pipeline from Turkmenistan to Karachi, to the port of Karachi there. And others say, no, they're trying to prevent. They're just stirring up all the violence because they want to just keep the whole region destabilized so that the Chinese can't build a pipeline from Iran. Or then others say, well, it's all just about, you know, the larger kind of project for a new American century, arc of crisis. We just have to keep our military presence, our footprint there as an eventual check on Russia and China and their power in Eurasia and this and that. But, you know, when I talk to my friend Gareth Porter, who's my favorite expert guest on this show, I interview him all the time. I'm sure you know him and read his work often. And he says, Horton, stop trying to find a reasonable explanation for this. There's not one. You know, it's you're basically speculating, trying to find you know, the math that fits. But this is basically what's happening here. The Pentagon has a strategy that says, if they resist us, kill them. And that's about it. And there's really all the grand strategy stuff in the world, the oil politics, even the airplane sales, the bullet sales, and all those things, that all that really is nothing. It really all just comes down to the will of the generals to continue doing what they're doing, to continue occupying the bases they occupy, to get more, to increase their own power and influence as generals, and to put more people on the ground killing people just because that's what they do. What do you think about that, Daniel Ellsberg?
Well, Gareth Porter is a close friend of mine, and we talk together a lot and analyze this stuff. I've had a running disagreement with him on one subject. I do think that in Iraq in particular, he... with his emphasis on the military motive, just for power, extension of power, and keeping at war, the motive for permanent war, in effect, in the army, underrates the role of oil. He very specifically does play down the role of oil in Iraq in particular, and I think I believe he's misled on that point. Afghanistan, it's true there are oil comes in, not only bases in the area, but the pipeline issue. But there, he has a stronger point. The prospects are so bad for a total, the word quagmire is not just a cliche, it's a reasonable description of a stalemate, but an escalating stalemate, a bloody stalemate. The prospects of that are so great that the economic motives, whatever they are, do seem to pale by any means. And even if they were much larger, as they were in Iraq, by the way, the prize of Iraqi oil is a very, very large prize. That doesn't justify our aggressive war, our crime against the peace. It doesn't justify the people we kill and the tides of refugees that we generate by our bombing. And the same is true in Afghanistan. And that seems so obvious that it raises the question of who are the people who are determining the policy? What are their motives? I'd have to say that there probably will for a very long time remain a kind of mystery about some of these motives, as there is still about Johnson. In Vietnam, Johnson, unknown to the public, was warned by some of his strongest Cold War supporters, people who had almost invented the Cold War, like Clark Clifford, who advised Harry Truman on the Cold War early policies, or Hubert Humphrey, who had tried, his vice president, who had tried to ban the Communist Party earlier, and people, and Fulbright, Richard Russell in the Senate, who couldn't be stronger as anti-communists or as Cold Warriors, nevertheless were telling Johnson, not this place. Do not plant the flag here. We will not do any better than the French, and that they were exactly right. We will lose. Actually, Clifford made an amazingly prescient prediction in July of 68-5, the very month I was working for him, and the very month that Johnson made the decision for an open-ended war in Vietnam, the same kind of decision, I believe, that Obama has just made. And Johnson was hearing from Clifford, Mr. President, I see nothing ahead but catastrophe for my country. Catastrophe is a word you just don't see in bureaucratic language.
You know? Well, you know, the clip of Johnson that I'm thinking of when you're talking about that is the one, I don't know who he's talking to, but there's a clip of Johnson where he says, look, I'm not going to be the first American president to lose a war. Okay, that's it. So send another 100,000.
Well, what Clifford and Humphrey and the head of INR, the State Department of Intelligence, Tom Hughes, and various other, and Russell, Johnson's mentor in the Senate and the head of the Armed Services Committee, were all telling him, if you go into Vietnam, you are going to be the president who loses a war. You are going to lose. We will lose. We will not succeed. And, you know, amazingly enough, in the tapes, it turns out later, Johnson isn't really disagreeing with that. He's saying to Russell, if I were them, I wouldn't give up. I don't think they'll ever give up. The bombing won't do it. We won't do it. And yet he went ahead. In the face of Clark Clifford's prediction to him, he said, 5 years, 500,000 men. That's exactly what we did put in 3 years. He said, 50,000 dead. An amazing prediction. We lost 58,000 dead before we got out. He said, that is not for us. It's catastrophe. Don't do it. And yet he was hearing this now from people whose advice he could not write down or ignore, and yet went ahead. So there remains a kind of mysterious aspect to that. What you can conclude is, don't trust a president to make wise, prudent decisions, or legal or moral or just rightful decisions for our own interests, for our own security, by himself in secret on these things. They're capable of making terrible errors and getting them obeyed, and having the people around them keep their mouths shut, as did Clifford and Humphrey, did not tell the public what they believed, what they foresaw. They did not give him the estimates that McNamara could have given later of just how badly mired we were in it. I have no doubt that there are people in the administration right now who see what we're heading into in Afghanistan as catastrophic in the region, in its effects on Pakistan, precisely the opposite of the effects they're talking about. They're saying they want to stabilize Pakistan. By every indication, this war will serve to destabilize Pakistan and to extend the war into Pakistan with the risks of Pakistan's nuclear weapons coming into the exclusive power of Taliban-like...
Yeah, isn't that funny? The excuse for why we need to intervene is the number one cause of why we might need to intervene, right? It's just like Vietnam, right? You bomb Cambodia until the government falls, then the Khmer Rouge takes over. Well, that's what we're doing to Pakistan, seemingly, is we're trying to unravel, it looks like, or at least where the people running the policy don't seem to mind that the actual danger of Pakistan, those nukes falling into the hands of crazies, is being made more likely every time they use a robot to murder some lady.
I agree with you, and it does seem hard to believe. You look, you stand back at that, and you say they're talking about stabilizing Pakistan while they are inciting an unprecedented hatred of this country. I wonder if there's ever been a country that hated the United States the way the people of Pakistan do, are reported to do right now.
And yeah,
while they're under, in those areas, continuous attack when humiliating and violations of their sovereignty. Their own government presumably lying to them when they say they're not cooperating. But that is precisely what will destabilize a government that is in fragile control of its nuclear weapons right now. So we ask, could it be that when they say they want to protect us from Pakistan's nuclear weapons, they want to stabilize Pakistan, could it be that they're really doing things that are designed, that will have the effect of destabilizing Pakistan, the opposite of what they say? All you have to do is look back at the plans I described earlier.
They descended on the city, tried to send Marines inside. The people fought with rockets and wouldn't make it out alive. They'd heard what they'd done in Baghdad, they'd heard how they shot to kill. They'd heard the news from other cities, how the hospitals were filled. They'd heard from Samara, how they come from all around. They'd formed a wall around them, how the snipers shot them down. How they'd sent the population fleeing for their lives. How they'd swept the streets for prisoners, how they'd cut the water lines. People knew that it was coming, it was written in the wind. City braced for murder with the army moving in. Folks rushed in with medicine, trying to get supplies. Sleepless nights were spent in wonder of who would not survive. They started getting ready as the day was coming close. Mujahideen fighters took up corner posts. Some fled for other cities, the rest dug in tight. The farmers of Fallujah would not get down without a fight. November 8th, the troops came pouring in. Bombs ripped apart the houses, people fought them from within. There were cluster bombs exploding, there was phosphorus gas. There were torturing the prisoners, flames were spreading fast. You couldn't walk the streets at night, a curfew was imposed. They ordered evacuations and they blocked the major roads. They were occupying houses, holding families under siege. Shooting from their windows, not letting people leave. And they were bombing indiscriminately, there were B-52s. They were picking off civilians, there were snipers on the roofs. They were shooting ambulances, there were bodies in the streets. There's 250,000 refugees and 100,000 people who fled have not returned. The air still thick with the smell of people's bodies left to burn. A quarter of the city blown apart by bombs. Now they're sorting through the rubble, picking up the crumbs. That was Fallujah, that was 2004. Soon Tal Afar would fall victim to the war. 3 years of slaughter, no plans to cease the line. The pockets of some people back in Washington, D.C. And it was just like Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They firebombed Dresden, how it spread from house to house. Paving through the neighborhoods, just like Jenin. Giving contracts to Halliburton, just like New Orleans.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.